Welcome to the Smichael Speaks podcast channel. I'm Joanne Smichael, and I'm delighted that you tuned in for relevant leadership learning that will help you continue to soar. Enjoy this episode. I'm very, very, very excited about our guest today and our topic today. It's Dr. Jen Douglas, who hails from San Diego, California. Her workbook, Freedom from Perfection, is a valuable tool for anybody who can't accept good, who can't accept great, or even can't accept excellent and is making themselves nuts striving for perfection. But I got to tell you, I want to talk to her about more than her workbook because she's doing a ton of work to enhance mental wellness. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited for this conversation.
So am I. Before we talk about your work, I want to talk about you. I know you're a wife. I know you're a mom. I know you're from a family where everybody's name starts with J.
I am all of those things, yes.
And I know that you're on the Council of Advisors for the Seek Her Foundation. So tell us about Seek Her. Tell us about you. Just tell us.
Of course. Absolutely. So I've been, you know, nerding out on mental health for a very, very long time. I exited college knowing I wanted to be a psychologist and have been on that path ever since. And I consider myself very lucky that I really consider my profession a calling, and working in mental health, especially for women, has just been such a rewarding process for me. And I've worked very hard, but I've also had a lot of good luck and a lot of privilege in being able to integrate my professional identity with my identity at home, and to be able to have what I call not work-life balance, but life-work balance. So the other way around. So I consider myself a very blessed person in this way. But I do work with some nonprofits. Seek Her is one of them. Seek Her is the nonprofit branch of WellSeek. WellSeek is an institution that does work on women's mental health within the professional sphere. And so they collaborate with large companies about how to enhance mental wellness for women, especially women of color, where it normally has been sort of brushed under the rug and you experience a lot of burnout, you see a lot of employee turnover. They're really there to enhance mental wellness programs and proper sort of treatment of women within the workforce. Now, their nonprofit arm, which I hold very near and dear to my heart and do a lot of work with, focuses on these issues, but with this lens towards helping train and continuous education for mental health providers for these populations, so in particular women's wellness, in particular women of color. And they also provide, they do a national survey every year to look at women's mental health within the workforce and sort of what women are up against. Do they feel like they really have a seat at the table? Do they feel like it's easy to participate, or are there invisible barriers to that participation? So they get a lot of really wonderful data that we really haven't had great access to before. So we do a lot of work getting the word out about that. And I think this is our fourth year now awarding grants. One of my favorite campaigns that they do is we call them the no grants. So women historically have been trained to say yes, or there's an assumption that the answer is yes when it comes to unpaid, you're nodding your head, unpaid labor by women. Yeah. And so these grants are awards of $2,000 each. I'm pretty sure we gave away 200 of them last year. So it was $400,000.
Wow, that's substantial.
It was really, really, a lot of good has been done by this nonprofit. And it was for women to have grants that would allow them to say no. So whether that was extra shifts or overtime, whether it was, you know, saying no to doing extra housework. We had a lot of applicants who had special needs kids and they haven't had a break for literally years. It allowed them to, you know, hire someone to watch the kids so that they could, you know, get a little bit of time to themselves. Just this beautiful diversity of how women were going to use this funding to have a little time for themselves and get a breath, pay for mental health care, whatever it might be. So it's a wonderful nonprofit that I just really enjoy working with.
Now, does Seek Her only serve populations in California?
No, it's national. Thank you for asking. No, it is absolutely national. It's wonderful. And we have, I think most of the live events are in California, although we're having one in Texas in about a month. But a lot of the work is done online to sort of break down those barriers to access. A lot of what we talk about is barriers to access. And I know you and I are going to talk about, virtual therapy and all these things, but we like to sort of, flatten the playing field so that everybody has access to these things, no matter where they live, what access they'd otherwise have.
Okay, and just tell us the web address now.
Oh, sure. I think it's seekher.org. Now I have to look because
Okay, check, look it up because I want to
I'm.
be sure that people have
Yes,
access.
seekher.org. This is the Seek Her Foundation. And power, you'll see when you come to the website, it's Powering Women for the Greater Good. And it's just a really beautiful community and set of resources. And then we're gathering data all the time that we can sort of make that connection to companies so that companies can see this is how women are really feeling, and they may not have the space to express it. So this is how you support women in your workforce.
Love it, love it,
That's
love it.
wonderful.
Now, I know you've got your PhD in clinical psychology from San
Yes.
Diego State,
Yes.
did your undergrad at Wesleyan, and
Yes.
you were on the faculty at Stanford, and you
Yes.
made a very difficult, very courageous
Oh.
decision. Very courageous.
That's
Let's
very
talk about
kind.
that.
That's very kind for you to say. It was so for those listening, I left my faculty position at Stanford a little over a year ago. And that was a huge shift for me because, and we'll talk about perfectionism as well, that our identity can get so wrapped up in achievement. And for those of us who went through the kind of traditional schooling and college and graduate school and all of this, to have sort of the pinnacle of our, feather in our cap type job, like, oh, I've been working my whole life to get a job like this. And then to realize, wait, this isn't actually working for the kind of life that I want in many different ways. Not just the, I would be gone for 12 hours a day, commuting more than an hour each way in Silicon Valley is not fun. And it was a very, very high stress job. I actually did the kind of therapy where you're on call 24 hours a day. And your clients can call you at 2 o'clock in the morning, which I was happy to do, honestly, when I was younger. I'm very passionate about what I do. So I was happy to do it when I was younger. Does not work so well once you start having children to be called at, all hours of the night. And, giving therapy at 3 o'clock in the morning does not work. And so there became, and the other thing about practicing in a large institution like that is that it can be restrictive in sort of how you operate, because they're telling you, okay, you're going to see this type of client, you're going to see them for this many sessions, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a bit less freedom in how much outreach you can do, the types of folks that you're seeing, the types of folks who can even get past the barriers to be seen at Stanford. We noticed the diversity of populations that we saw over the years were shrinking, because we had 2-year-long wait lists. If somebody
Barriers to
said,
access.
exactly. And so it was so frustrating. And so I had been doing my own practice and consulting outside of Stanford for about 5 years. And I slowly realized that that was really where my heart lay. It was in, helping these nonprofits. I do a huge amount of outreach on social media. I reach about 40,000 people a month. And then I can see people sort of on my and their timelines individually, as well as speaking, and all these other kind of aspects of what I do. Whereas, Stanford had this very traditional way of looking at mental health, which is, perfectly fine and has its place. But when you have a 2+ year long wait list, it wasn't speaking to me.
No. And that is an indictment on our healthcare system, period.
Exactly. It's not a Stanford problem, it's an everywhere problem.
Yeah, it is. And it's a scary everywhere
Yes,
problem.
it is. It is.
Yeah. So you have really strong academic credentials. You do a lot of work in what I call bridge building. You've done teaching related to diversity and inclusion in the therapy room
Yes.
specifically.
Yes.
What sparked your curiosity on that dynamic in the therapy room? I'm very
Yes.
curious about it because I'm looking at you and you are not a woman of
I'm a
color.
nice white lady, yes. I do not look like the average person. So this actually comes back to the very core of why I became a psychologist. So I was actually going to be a lawyer when I was an undergrad, and I took a class on eating disorders because it took place on a Friday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And that meant I could go out partying on Thursday nights. So I took this class. And I went to a very small university, and it just happened to have one of the literally world-renowned experts on eating disorders. And some of the work that she did was dismantling the stereotype that the people who have eating disorders are high-income white women. And she was part of this research that really showed that women of color have eating disorders at the same rate or higher than white women, and that it is that income does not determine whether or not you have an eating disorder. It very much can determine whether or not you're properly diagnosed with an eating disorder and get effective treatment. But that really sparked something in me because it was this intersection between what I love about working in disordered eating, which is one of the things that I do, is this it's this intersection of mental health, often trauma, often intergenerational trauma, and also feminism. And then you have the diversity element on top. And so it really is this beautiful way where you, when you treat someone's eating disorder, you are dismantling elements of sexism, racism, fat phobia, all of these things that I would like to see eradicated in the world. And so that sort of started me on this continuous journey of looking at eating disorders in LGBTQ populations, looking at it in Black women, looking at it in Hispanic women, and pulling out some of that research. And the really unfortunate fact of the matter is that there are so many barriers to doing some of the things that I've done that there aren't enough women of color in these fields. And so I think the most valuable thing that I've ever done is try to pull more people who do not look like me into these spaces. So Stanford actually asked me to do their diversity course. They didn't have one when I was training there. So they asked me to do a diversity course. And I said, well, I'm only going to do it if it's co we're not going to have a diversity course taught by a straight white woman. Like, that's not going to work. And so they got a lot of work to do. They're working on it. But there's this wonderful curriculum called Intergroup Dialogue, which I'm not sure if you've heard of.
I have not.
It's wonderful. It's in the education space in DEI. And what you do is you have a professor of color, and then you have a white professor, and they're co-teaching these classes. And so what's really beautiful about it is, and the idea is that you can create space where, I as the white professor can say, yeah, I didn't think about these things, until I was 25 years old. I don't need to wonder if the security guard is looking me up and down at Target as I walk in or walk out. But then you have somebody who may have experienced some of that racism, may have experienced some of that prejudice, and then they can talk about it as well. And as soon as you get, this is kind of the newer the newer approach to both teaching and therapy is the old approach is okay, well, the professor or the therapist knows everything and they're going to, they have all the power in the room, and then the student or the therapy receiver is going, the patient is going to receive that information, and it's kind of this one-way street. Whereas this is designed to create a flat dynamic so that you're really allowing people to be vulnerable, you're really allowing people to be authentic, and that's when you have these valuable conversations. So I think that's, and I think we need more white women doing this and opening the doors and bringing folks along who historically have not been able to have those roles of power automatically in the way that I was literally asked to do this.
So let's talk about the therapy room.
Yeah. Let's talk about
So let's talk
the
about the therapy room. You
room.
know, we I want to talk about what role diversity plays in there and how, and I do believe we all have human connections, but I know I experience the world differently as a woman of color than you
Yes.
do.
Yes.
I know that.
Yes.
So how does that play out in the therapy room?
So I'm so glad that you said that. And if you were ever going to go to therapy and ever going to work with a therapist, and they said that you don't experience the world differently as a woman of color, you should immediately fire the therapist and find a different one.
Run, Forrest, run.
Run. And unfortunately, I'm terrified to know what percentage of therapists would say that and wouldn't acknowledge that. So let me give you actually, oh, I know, I realize we're not on video for your listeners. But I'm going to grab, hold on one second. Meant to grab this, but I didn't before we started. Okay. So this is our tome. This is our textbook, essentially, that all therapists use. This is as all the diagnoses that you use, you need it for insurance, all these different things. This is called the DSM. Now, only about 10 years ago, they added a little section on diversity, and it's about this big.
Yeah, it is a little section in that
It's
huge book.
a huge
Yeah.
book. There's
Huge
about,
book.
yeah, huge book,
Yeah.
tiny little section. And notice,
Yeah.
this is what makes me so angry. It makes my blood boil. It's at the back,
I see that. I see
right?
that.
And so here are all this information, decades of research on depression, anxiety, OCD, trauma. And then at the very end, it says, oh, well, there might be these considerations, for Asian American populations, for Black populations, et cetera. And that is not how therapy should work. Someone's culture, their history, their family's immigration story, how they experience the world, how they're treated day to day, whether somebody is being looked in the eye and treated with respect as an equal in everyday interactions affects mental health from the ground up. It is not an afterthought.
Love it, love it, love it. So now, when you were working on your doctorate in clinical psychology, you think you came out of that program well prepared for treating people of different races, classes, gender identities, other forms of diversity? Did you leave that program ready to tackle the real world?
I should not be. I'm literally laughing. It was laughable. It was absolutely laughable. We had one course, and I don't think this has changed in the 15 years that I've been out. Wow, just aged myself a bit. So I don't think this has changed. There was one semester course. It was taught by a wonderful woman, and a woman of color, which was great, which is not the case in many doctorate programs because there's not enough diversity on the faculty. We could talk about that for hours and why that is. But it absolutely didn't prepare you. And there were layers of diversity that really weren't even discussed. And I remember actually taking one course on diversity. I think this was at Stanford. But I remember we had some diversity seminar, and it might not have been at Stanford, so don't quote me on that. But we had a diversity seminar, and I said to the head of the program after it was done, I said, you had an entire diversity class and you never said the word racism out loud.
Wow.
We've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah. And I'm concerned that we're going backwards. Very concerned. That's a whole nother podcast.
That's a couple
So,
years of podcasts.
yeah. So, if you got the opportunity to enhance the curriculum in that area, what would you do differently?
God. I would redesign the whole thing from the ground up. Honestly, before you go in and you start teaching people, like the first class you take in psychology, you take assessment. And so you learn the interviews to give to diagnose anxiety, depression, OCD, whatever you're going to diagnose. And those are fairly set in stone. And then later, if you seek it out, or if you're lucky enough to be in a program that teaches you this, you actually learn that, for instance, African American adults exhibit depression in different ways than white adults. And those interviews are designed and have always been designed for white adults. And so I would not teach assessment, quote unquote, because it's not really assessment for the global majority. I would not teach assessment first. I would teach culture and DEI as the basis, and then you add psychology on top because so many people come out of their undergraduate careers not having been taught anything about this, not having thought about how their own culture is affecting how they walk through the world and how it's different than other folks. So I would start there and then start adding the psychology on top of it because if you start to add culture later, you're just adding footnotes and it's too late.
And that's frightening because that's the educational model that still persists. So that is frightening. Curiosity, we talked a little bit about women and mental health. I want to go back to that and I want to just check in on some of your observations related to the needs that we as women have related to our mental well-being. How do our needs differ from those of men? And just what are you seeing with women and mental health?
Absolutely. So, women, we're naturally social. We're not naturally, sorry. Women are socialized differently than men. We are taught that our value is intrinsically linked to how we participate in the community and how we support others. Now, that is not a negative thing. It actually builds resilience in mental health for women. If you look at women compared to men, women have a lot of mental resilience because they're so plugged into their community. So this is a good thing. However, one thing that I always talk about in therapy is that anything is good or bad depending on your dosage. So being plugged into your community and supporting one another is a wonderful thing in the proper dose. However, at this point in society, women are expected to raise babies as if we don't work. Work as if we don't have babies, somehow still look 25 forever, like also have an active, charitable, spiritual life. There are all of these different things, and make a home-cooked meal every night, which I just have never done and will never do. It's the expectations on women are so exhausting and insurmountable and unachievable that women are left feeling less than, no matter how hard we try.
And it's frightening because I think that sometimes people are trapped, don't know they're trapped, and they are so burned out in every area of their lives. And a
Yes.
big part of it is because it can't say no. And so I love the Seek
The
Her No
note,
grants.
yes.
I
Wonderful.
love that. I love that. I love that. So, what are the ways in which therapy should be different for women than for men?
That's such a wonderful question. You know what's sad is I don't think that question was ever asked in graduate school. Don't think that happened until later. So the same thing that we were already talking about, thinking about how someone moves through the world, thinking about how they plug into their community, and acknowledging that that can be someone's values. We would never want to impose certain boundaries or values that don't align with the client. If you look at culturally incompetent therapy, and that includes, gender, then if somebody says, "Oh, you just need to say no, you just need to, cut this person out of your life, et cetera," it falls so flat and it can cause so much harm, and the person will run from therapy and they will never come back. And so it's actually harming their mental health long term. So what I do with women, and this should be done with men as well, but it's particularly important and salient for women, is we talk about their values. And so I have somebody literally list out everything that's important to them about their life. And so they're going to say, I want to be able to pick up my kids from school. I want to be able to get this promotion at work because I've been working for it for 10 years. I want to be, able to enjoy my husband and not just resent him. Whatever they are. And then we rank them. And one of the hardest things to do is acknowledge that we don't have enough time and space and energy in our lives to have all of those things at once.
And that is not just true for women who are married and have kids.
Yes, thank
Because
you.
sometimes we have
Yes.
this crazy notion that A, all women are married and have
Yep,
children,
yep.
and all women want to be married and have six kids, and the diversity among women and women's needs is huge.
Yes. And the rates of
And
marriages are going down. The young people want nothing to do. Many young people want nothing to do with this impossible thing. And yes, it's a whole other conversation.
Yes. And I think it's important to surface that
Yes.
it's not just the mom's dilemma, it's the woman's dilemma, and it looks different for every single woman.
Absolutely. And that's my bias because I'm sitting here having just had a second baby. And so you can see my bias in going to like the example is automatically my experience. And that's what's so important when we're talking about being conscientious in the therapy room of your life experience and your biases and how that goes to the surface and if that's not serving your client.
I'm glad that you have that awareness, and I hope that lots more people in your profession are developing that. I want to talk about the need for therapy. Like, I'm a big believer that therapy is something that 98.75% of the population needs, even though so many people are reluctant to get it. And sometimes it's easier for other people to see that we need a mental health intervention than it is for the individual. So, what are the signs that a person, a woman, a man, what are the signs that anyone should pay attention to? The kind of the flags that should let them know it's time to get some mental health treatment. What are those signs or those flags?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up flags. So with my clients, when my clients graduate from therapy and they fly off, we talk about red flags that they should come back, whether it's to me or anybody else. But we also talk about pink flags or peach flags. So the precursors, because we don't want to wait until it gets to a red flag. I mean, so the average person, it takes them 7 years to seek out therapy after first developing symptoms. Doesn't that just break your heart in a thousand
That is
pieces?
so sad.
It's so sad.
So
It's so
sad.
sad. And I have a lot of faith in, the new generations. It's being more socially acceptable. That's part of the reason I'm on social media. It's kind of more in our conversation now, but there are so many barriers. So people have been coming when they get to the red flags. And this is when people walk in and they'll tell me, "Oh, I think I need therapy," and they describe one of the worst cases of depression I've ever seen. They're not getting out of bed, they're, not showering, they're living off of ramen noodles because they can't, make a meal, that takes more than 2 minutes in the microwave. Those are the kind of symptoms we see when depression's really bad. I want people to come in earlier than that because no one deserves to feel that badly before they come in. And so these are things like irritability.
Yeah,
So,
when you're grouchy, when you're crotchety all the time.
when you're crotchety all the time, when little things bother you that don't normally bother you, when you find yourself, cursing that your shoes are out of place, in the morning, that's a sign. Trouble sleeping. So whether and it's some people think about insomnia, but also sleeping too much or feeling always tired or kind of dragging. Those types of things. And also isolation is the big one, which can relate to irritability. So if you find yourself canceling plans or not really responding to messages and sort of not being engaged, that's a really telltale sign that there's something that's not quite right.
So those are the kind of big signs. Are there more subtle ones?
Yes, yeah. So now we can go into peach flags. This is
Okay.
very So some of these are things like, and again, everything is on a continuum and everything can be healthy in doses. And then when the dose gets too big, can be more unhealthy. So if we care a lot about our performance at work, we might think about work occasionally outside of, our work hours. So, okay, I'm in the shower and I'm like, oh, how am I gonna, talk about this today in this meeting? That's all fine. If you find yourself worrying, or we call it ruminating, when it goes over and over and over in your head, that can be a sign that some anxiety might be kicking up into sort of more of the range where you might want to get a little bit of help. Yeah. If you find yourself not enjoying things, so, say you see your friends on the weekend or you, do something fun with your kid and it kind of falls flat, that can also be a sign. So it's not always feeling negative for many folks, and actually, this is how it comes up more in African American populations. It's actually feeling this reduced emotional band where things feel kind of flat and you may feel more apathy. That's how it can sometimes look.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I keep seeing these commercials on TV for virtual therapists. I call it therapist in a box. Therapist in a box. And I'll just tell the truth. I am so leery of that. I mean, first of all, did you get your degree from a diploma mill? And I'm admitting these are my biases. So to my listeners who are offended, please understand this is a bias that I have and I get to have them. Just like everybody else gets to have their biases. So I'm leery of that. I want my therapist to be known to me. I prefer somebody right here in my community. What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts
Absolutely.
on this kind of trend towards the doc in the box?
The dog of the I love that. So Everyone's needs for therapy are so unique and different. I have, when COVID happened, for instance, I was so scared to do virtual therapy. I had been doing it a little bit with some of my clients before COVID, but then everything shut down and everything had to go virtual. And I was so worried. There were a couple of clients in particular. I'm like, they like the in the room feeling. They're going to hate this. I hope they're going to stick with it, you know, so we can get through this. You know, at the time we thought it was going to be 2 weeks. Remember that? So, and then those particular two clients I'm thinking of, I was so worried about, they were thrilled with it because it took them like 2.5 hours to go to therapy because they had to commute to my office, do therapy, go back, all these things in the middle of a work day. And so for many people, the virtual therapy thing really breaks down a lot of access issues. When I treat people with chronic pain, they were having a lot of trouble getting to the office. So if you're in a lot of pain, you don't have to come. So there can be virtues of the virtual therapy. However, when you're talking about, you know, vetting a therapist, making sure that they're connected to your community, making sure that they're well trained, making sure that they connect well with you. For many people, virtual therapy is not it, is never going to be it, and that is absolutely fine. Like that's a wonderful way to narrow down what therapist you want to find, because the hardest thing I think about therapy is actually finding a good therapist and finding a good match.
Yeah, I have firsthand experience with
Oh,
that.
I'm so
And
sorry.
oh no,
It's
I mean, I
terrible.
have been blessed to have the right one for me.
Wonderful.
So I just feel very fortunate in that. Very, very fortunate. That's a big blessing.
Yes.
So when they're shopping around, they're looking
Yes.
for what? Credentials, comfort, what else?
So we have data, and I'm giggling because it was so important to me to, you know, go to all these great schools and get all these fancy degrees, and I'm going to get the PhD instead of the master's and all this stuff. We have data that the most important thing about your therapist is not the modality they're using and not the level of degree they have. It is your connection to that therapist.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Isn't
That is
that
very
wild?
interesting. Yeah.
And therapists will
Yeah.
fight each other. Like we'll be like, I believe in this kind of therapy. I believe in this kind of therapy. That therapy is awful. It doesn't actually matter as much as the connection. Now, obviously, there are some caveats to that. You know, we have empirically based trauma therapy, and then we have not empirically based therapy. You know, there's certain things that you want your therapist to have if you're seeking out specific care for specific things. But if you have a therapist that you don't connect with, that you don't trust, that you don't feel comfortable with, like within 2 minutes of getting on this call, I could tell that I was comfortable with you and this was going to be a wonderful conversation. That's what you're looking for with a therapist. You're looking, it's not going to happen in 2 minutes, but you're looking for that level of comfort beyond anything else. And so that may involve, you know, I seek out folks who are going to understand a bit about me, who are going to have some life experience that aligns with mine. You know, it doesn't have to be one for one.
Right.
My therapist is a single woman who never had kids and is crushing it and flying internationally all the time, you know, and she's like this professional absolute powerhouse, and she's a wonderful therapist for me. So it doesn't have to be a one-to-one match.
Right.
But you want to make sure that if the person doesn't share that experience, they have learned or will learn so that they can understand your lived experience.
I like that you said that because it is that connection, and we don't have to have the exact same path and the exact same life. I know for me, it was important to find somebody who understood the fact that I'm a no-nonsense person. We're not going to waste a whole
Yes.
lot of time on pleasantries. I'm going to
Yes.
sit down and tell you what's on my mind, and I get to question you just like you get to question me. Those things were
Yes.
important.
Yes. I say
Very,
I'm not a
very.
fluffy therapist. I'm like, I lived in New York. You've got to be on board with that if you want to work with me. You know, since communication style is really important.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. And I think sometimes people forget that you get to fire your therapist, you get to
Yes.
outgrow them, you get
Yes.
to, go to one session and say, oh no, this
Yeah.
person is not for me.
Yes.
So I think that people need to be reminded of that.
Yes. And a good therapist, because I not enough people know this, a good therapist, if you see a therapist once or twice or three times and they don't work out, or if you've seen someone for years and you say, you know, I actually want something different, a good therapist will not be offended by that, and they will help find someone who's a better match for you. because we know, I think that's the best way to find somebody is through people you know and through therapists who know other therapists who have that specialty.
We've had fun talking about
Yeah.
this mental health, mental wellness. We never got to your book, but we will.
It's fine.
but
It's still there. I'm
before
not.
we before we wrap up, I do want to talk about one other area, and that's mental health with young people.
Yes.
We won't get to talk about it today, but is it something that you're willing to come back and chat about?
I would love to. I think it's so important. I think that would be a wonderful idea.
Thank you. And thanks for sharing your time, your energy, your enthusiasm. I love it and I appreciate you, Jen. So we're going to have another conversation,
Yes,
right?
please. I would love that. Please have me
Thanks
back. This is fantastic.
for being part of the Smichael Speaks podcast channel. Thanks for listening to this podcast. I hope you got tools that you'll actually use and share. Subscribe if you haven't already. I add new and relevant leadership learning all of the time. If you haven't visited the Smichael Speaks YouTube channel, check it out. There's all sorts of new content. All of this is virtual leadership learning that will help you soar.